Now taxes is 100% free when you file in the TurboTax app if you didn't file with us last year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Just do your own taxes in the app by 2/18.
What if I have lots of forms?
All good. All 100% free.
What if I had three jobs?
Still 100% free.
What if I once saw Bigfoot?
That has nothing to do with taxes, so still 100% free.
Now that's what I'm talking about.
Now this is taxes. See if you qualify in the TurboTax app. Excludes TurboTax Live. Must start and file in app by 2/18.
Hair thinning can happen for so many reasons. Whether it's stress or hormones or anything, at Nutrafol, we've learned that real change starts below the surface. Our hair growth supplements take a whole body approach and target the key root causes of hair thinning, so you can see visibly thicker, stronger hair in 3 to 6 months.
Hair growth starts from the inside at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com.
Andrew Callahan is the host of the Channel 5 News YouTube channel.
Channel 5.
Oh, yeah. You're watching Channel 5 News.
He is a fearless journalist whose open and unorthodox approach has gotten him into some crazy situations. As well as created friction with the mainstream media.
Mainstream media, like Fox and even CNN, competes for views by running constant 24-hour news cycles.
First of all, I don't agree with what you're saying.
We talk about the roots of political radicalization and how to heal it, the differences between the psychology of the right and left in America, and Andrew's experience with Americans at their most beautiful and their most extreme.
What do you know about America that I and everyone else doesn't? You are so knowledgeable about America. What do you know about America that I and everyone else doesn't?
I don't know how much you know about the United States. However, you're from Philly and you live here in Malibu, which gives you a pretty good two-pronged outlook.
Uh-huh. So, I mean, I guess when you look at mainstream representations of America, what is wrong in that?
Well, I think a lot of people don't know about like cultural micro regions, as they call it. You know what I mean? Like a lot of people don't know that Southwest Louisiana is like a Cajun swamp area and that Creole Louisiana is by, you know, St. Martinville up in the north central part of the state. Mm-hmm. There's random stuff that you don't see on the map. But if I were to say that my outlook is unique, it would just be in terms of cumulative knowledge of small towns.
Okay.
Like I just know about a bunch of dope ass small towns.
it sounds like there isn't the average American in the same way that, I don't know, it's often represented, your average Republican, your average Democrat.
Yeah, America's great. Yeah. I mean, all the people we have here is dope. Yeah,
all the people.
Probably not our foreign policy. That's why I say I'm a patriot for the humans of America, not necessarily America as a global entity.
Got it. Speaking of one American, we were going to start the podcast with this. You said the thing about Chet Hanks.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks' son. What were you
Well, the thing is, Chet Hanks' Jamaican accent is amazing. He does one of the best Jamaican accents, I think, is possible from a non-Jamaican person.
We'll cut that in right here, by the
way.
Big up the youth, them way out of Kingston. We wake up this morning and we see the thing turn up. Internet gone mad. Respect, you don't know. The soon forward a yard. Booyaka, booyaka.
And he was actually ahead of his time because whenever he did the Jamaican accent, he aced it. They made fun of him. The New Yorker called him like the king of cultural appropriation. But White Boy Summer was so powerful that it kind of blasted through all that noise. Mm. And today, Chet is revered as an icon amongst white Americans and the Jamaican populace.
Okay. Yeah, there was and he was doing that in the midst when cultural appropriation was like one of the most grievous sins that you could possibly commit.
Yeah, people were pissed.
Do you have a sense of, do you think it was just because it was a good accent of why he got away with that?
He got away with it because he aced so many specific catchphrases. Uh-huh. I don't know if that's the word for it, but there's various idioms that you wouldn't just be able to learn about from watching, you know, Jamaican television. Like he was clearly learning from a lot of in the field experience.
Yes, which I think speaks to, in a weird way, like the authenticity of it, you know, like even though he's obviously not from Jamaica and is Tom Hanks' son, which I don't understand how that happened, there was an authenticity to his love for it. And also whenever I think it was on like Z-Way, that show or something, when he would get teased for it, the non-reactivity that he had around it and like he just felt zero shame for it. And I actually think that a lot of people who critique other people for cultural appropriation, many of them are not really upset about it. It seems like a power move. And when people don't respond to it,
It's typically like white infighting. Yeah. Like, that's wrong. I think that the onus, if that's the word, of cultural appropriation should be placed upon the group itself. Like, if they think you did a good job and you're being tasteful, then you're probably doing okay.
Got it.
But if they're like, yo, that's lame. You know what I mean? Then that's the group that is being appropriated. So you should listen to them first. And the Jamaicans show Chet the most love.
Is that true?
Yeah, big time.
Okay.
Go to Chet Hanks' comments.
Yeah.
Jamaican Queens, the whole comments.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good insight. And it's also why the Latinx term didn't stick. Because it was like, you know, loved by white America, despised by Latinos. Yeah.
I think it sticks in certain like cultural sub-circles, like in gentrified spaces.
Uh-huh.
You know, because that's a way for like just leverage to be weighed against others in those spaces.
This is interesting because we're sort of getting to this idea of groups who talk about other groups mm-hmm. for their benefit versus the experience of the group themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what is my question here?
I like that this conversation because it's the complete opposite of the subject matter of the movie. However, yeah. It's extremely important.
We're going to get there. I promise. We're going to
get there. I'm seeing it. I'm seeing the charisma manifest itself right now.
Okay, so because... in preparation for this, I watched some of your interviews with Don Lemon and on the NPR woman, who I know is very challenging. And I guess what I'm noticing is this judgmental, holier than thou, you're doing it wrong attitude mm-hmm. that seems to be passed down from on high. And what we're sort of saying here is that, but that's not like the reality on the ground. Like cultural appropriation on the ground is not the issue that it is dictated to us from some of the talking heads.
But there is genuinely like poverty and, you know, structures that were implemented in the 60s, especially with redlining and, you know, predatory mortgage stuff like that mm-hmm. is still unfolding to this day. Mass incarceration is real. Poverty and segregation is still real. You still see the legacy and the impacts. But, you know, unfortunately, it seems like those things aren't talked about. And instead, they take a backseat to these surface level identity clashes.
Mm. Interesting.
And that's part of the reason that so many people pivoted right, I think, this year in this election with electing Trump and stuff, is because on the right wing, you have this like mass collectivism. Like I've said before, if you go to a conservative MAGA rally, you can have like a Bitcoin libertarian, ayahuasca drinking weed guy from like Arizona who lives in his van and is pretty much like a conservative hippie standing directly next to like a pro-life activist, evangelical Christian who believes that like marijuana was created by the devil to, you know, seduce white women into having interracial children. And they're seemingly getting along with each other because they support a common cause. They're like, I disagree with you on every single issue, but you like Trump and you hate liberals, so we're in this together. Whereas on the other side of the aisle, you'd be lucky if you could mobilize a group of 10 leftists because it's the hyper-individualism that's manifested among identity lines has made it impossible for them to really work together to manifest real change and mobilize, which is why the Democrat Party was so weak in both reaching them and speaking for them, because they can barely muster up enough energy to speak for themselves.
Huh.
And not only that, but you have a lot of well-intentioned people who are progressive leaning and they're in college or whatever, especially like younger white dudes, and they're being told like, hey, your perspective isn't very important because you sit at this certain point in the privilege totem pole, so you should hold space. I understand their intention in doing that, and a lot of times like there is like annoying ass loud rich white kids on campus who like want to fucking talk the whole time. So I get it. But then they look at that and think, you know what? That kind of pissed me off. And then there's this whole conservative youth infrastructure with Turning Point that's like, yeah, fuck all that. Come to our side. Like, you're the man. And then that's why so many people pivoted right.
Hmm.
Among other things.
What do you see as that cohesive thing? Is it Trump? Because you mentioned we can disagree on all these things that we are on the surface level care deeply about and we'll make a lot of noise about. But as long as we have whatever this similarity is, we don't care. What is the similarity that allows for that cohesion on the right?
I just think that I really don't even know. It's really definitely fascinating. I think that during COVID, conservatism became counterculture.
Yeah.
Because it used to be the conservative party was like all about listening to the police and the government and adhering to these official narratives. And then liberals were all about like, we're not going to take it. Fuck the system. I'm not listening to you. And then COVID came around and there was obviously a Democratic establishment in the CDC who was telling people to stay home and stuff.
Yeah.
And then the conservative freedom movement of like, we're not going to take it. You know what I mean? That took the place of what was counterculture. And I think we're kind of living still in the shadow of 2020.
Yeah. I like that a lot. This is okay. I promise. I knew I would get here to your movie. I was fascinated with Dear Kelly because to me, the part that I find really interesting is the psychological underpinnings of politics. I think a lot of people talk about politics like it's the foundation of their life, like it's really the most important thing. But underneath that, you see their personal history and their personal psychology informing a lot of that. And I think that's why like you're saying, that there's this countercultural thing on the right that is so much more important than any particular political issue. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do we feel about authority? It's like, fuck authority, you know? And, and there's some of that, there's a lot of that on the left too, but it has a particular flavor on the right. So that's my piece. That's what I saw in Dear Kelly. Yeah. I'm curious if that's, you know, what drew you to that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely accurate. And also, as far as like, you know, people always ask me, why don't you make a reverse version of Dear Kelly? Because obviously the film is about a person that's pretty far down the conservative rabbit hole. And I think that conservatism itself is about mythologizing. And
before we go to, can you give just who is Kelly for those people?
Kelly Johnson, aka Kelly J. Patriot, is a conservative activist who I first met at the White Lives Matter rally in 2021. And the film was shot over the course of 4 years and explores his life and his radicalization through the lens of his family.
Okay.
Anyways, the movie is about like him, right? And conservatism itself is built upon the mythology of like a past, like make America great. Progressivism is built upon the mythology of like a utopian future. So in that same way, I think that, you know, having a perfect life and those needs collapsing kind of creates that conservative radicalization pipeline. Whereas the liberal radicalization pipeline, I think, comes from those needs being overfulfilled to the point that you feel so bad about how good your life is that that overwhelming white guilt and class guilt causes you to develop like hyper sympathy for people you don't even know. And so there's two types of pipelines. I just happen to be more curious about the more conservative pipeline. And that started because back in 2019 at the Flat Earth Conference back in the day, I covered it. It was in Texas. Like, flat earthers are like off their rocker. They think Adolf Hitler lives underneath Antarctica in a secret city where they're controlling the firmament above the surface of our two-dimensional planet plane, and that Hitler is still alive and he knows about the flat earth because he's the homie.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Wait. So like, of the flat earth pie chart,
yes,
the flat pie, what percentage of people believe that Hitler is underground doing this? Like
30-40%.
So it's a significant portion of the, wow.
Well, the whole flat earth movement thinks Hitler wasn't that bad.
Okay.
The people who think he was actually under the ice is a little bit under half. But they all think that Hitler and flat earth have some kind of spiritual connection.
That's fascinating, because as someone who didn't know that, I would never think that Hitler would be connected with the shape of the planet that we were on.
Well, Hitler didn't like Jews, obviously.
Yeah.
And a lot of the conspiracy theorists think that Jews control everything. And so Hitler kind of fits into that picture quite well.
And so I guess here's the psychological piece that I'm sort of working out now, is that the Jews are a stand-in for the other, the person in control who is holding me down and it down, and that has rigged the game against me and is feeding me false information in order to harm me. And I guess that's the attraction to Hitler, is if that's what the Jews are, and he didn't like the Jews, and I don't like the people who are standing above me controlling me.
Yeah.
And they've also lied about the shape of the planet in order to control me. Okay, so that's the thread that seems to tie all that stuff together.
And they think that just like Hitler knows the truth about the flat earth, the Jews control NASA. And so they're creating all of this satellite imagery to advance the global Jewish agenda. Anyways, I'd post videos of these people talking. And in the comment section, obviously it's mostly people making fun of them.
Yeah.
But every time there'd be one or two comments that would say like, oh my God, this is my cousin Chris. He hasn't been the same after his workplace accident. Or, oh my God, this is my dad. Him and my mom divorced and we haven't seen him in 2 years. Has anybody seen this guy?
Wow.
So I already had in my head for a long time that most people in the conservative rabbit hole, like super deep in it, had some kind of like core need collapsing, earth-shattering personal event that far predated their involvement in politics. Mm-hmm. And Kelly became the surrogate to really prove that theory. Yeah.
Got it. And is that what you – so I've watched the movie and I know Kelly's story. Talk a little bit about it for those who haven't seen it.
Yeah, so in 2017, I think, you know, so actually this goes back to the financial crisis in 2008. Obviously, I'm not exactly sure what happened, but I've seen The Big Short. It's got something to do with
Margot Robbie in a bathtub.
Yeah, people had problems with their houses.
Yeah.
And so he lost his house as a result of, I mean, a lot of it was his own decision making, but he took a loan from a lender who he believes is predatory. So he took a loan from a guy, he couldn't pay the loan back. That guy seized his house as a way to repay the loan, like a security interest.
Mm-hmm.
That lender was named Bill Joyner. So Kelly spent 6 years relentlessly suing Bill Joyner in court, putting up flyers around Bill Joyner's neighborhood, calling him a domestic terrorist. Like, his life became one massive revenge quest against Bill Joyner, who he's never met before.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill became this nebulous force of evil who took Kelly's life away from him. Because before the foreclosure, Kelly had a high-paying job, beautiful, healthy children. He was making money. He had 47 animals. Had pygmy goats walking around, stingrays, goldfish, like a true utopian American cul-de-sac lifestyle. Mm-hmm. That collapses. He gets a personal boogeyman. 2020 comes around. He hears about Trump and the deep state and how they were trying to steal the election from him. And it was as simple as, you know, they're trying to steal the election from Trump and Bill Joyner stole my home. So his personal battle became kind of more for the grander spiritual war in the country between good and evil, aka conservatives, Democrats.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the you are familiar with it. Do you know the term projection as it relates to psychology?
Yeah.
I can't help but see a ton of that there, which is like both with the Jews that we just described there. And it's usually this force that I have very little contact with. So it's very easy to project on because, you know, they're out there somewhere. Bill Joyner, this guy that I've never met. If he'd met him, it'd be harder, I'm sure, to like project onto him because he would become a flesh and blood human.
Yeah.
That is the cause of all of the things in my life that I don't want to take responsibility for.
Exactly.
And I think you did it was well timed in the documentary as you sort of investigated mm-hmm. Kelly's contribution to his own sort of financial downfall.
Yeah. And you brought up a great point about projection also, which leads me to another thing, which is it's way easier to hide in your own self mythology mm-hmm. than it is to admit fault in a situation.
Yes.
Even if you got fucked over, there's always some level of responsibility to be taken. Mm-hmm. But when you live in self mythology, heroic self mythology, mm-hmm. it's very comforting, even though that might take the visual form of rage. You might look at someone pissed off, but that's their happy place mm-hmm. because it allows them to feel like they're still in the game.
Hmm. I think that So I think that when a lot of people, myself included, see people that are angry or enraged, mm-hmm. there's a feeling of defense and fear that can mm-hmm. kick in. And sometimes that looks like I'm going to get angry back at that person. Yeah. You with Kelly entered with such curiosity. Mm-hmm. Everyone around him was like ripping his sign away, ready to punch him, ready to destroy the guy. But you were very curious and interested in him. And I think that speaks a lot to the success that you have in interviews that mainstream seems to struggle to understand. Like, how do you get these people to open up to you? How did you get into a QAnon house? And you're just like, I spoke to them.
It's unbelievably easy.
Yeah.
People ask me, like, how do you get access to these people? I don't think they understand how easy it is to get people to open up to you if you just listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's the easiest thing in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, what seems to be in the way for a lot of people is when they have an opinion of what that person ought to do. Yeah. And all of the questions, for instance, that I've seen journalists ask to these type of people, and I saw that NPR woman ask to you, were veiled statements about, you know, don't you think that it's wrong to speak to Alex Jones or things of that nature?
What she said is, what do you think the Sandy Hook families would have to say about you platforming one of the most evil people in history? I'm like, is that a question? It sounds like an assertion, which I can only defend with, but like, it's just, I can't believe that is NPR. But then mm-hmm. if you've ever been interviewed by mainstream media, that is what they do. They're just waiting for you to slip up and give you and produce a soundbite or a quote that can run a smear.
Well, it seems like you're genuinely able to enter with openness and curiosity. And I know that seems very simple to you, but it's not to many. And do you have a sense of why or how that is for you?
Man, the world is just a fascinating place. I guess I was just born curious. I want to learn more about everything all the time.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious about everything all at once. Mm-hmm. You know, and so when I meet someone, I'm not pretending to be non-judgmental. I literally just want to know more about, you know, what they're up to.
Yeah. How do you... Or do you have to? Because for some people, holding their own politics at bay is very challenging for them in that moment where they go, no, that's wrong. Or didn't you know? Or didn't you see this news report on the thing?
Yeah.
Do you have that urge or are you not deeply? Because I know that you have your own historical and political beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, generally, like, I think that most people who are furious in the streets holding signs that I disagree with, like, I probably have more in common with them than I do with the person that fed them the information. I think the real people to blame aren't the individual January 6th Capitol rioters or Antifa rioters or people in the streets. Mm. It's the systems and the people controlling these media systems and the politicians who are deliberately feeding on these people's insecurities to get them to, like, you know, go out and do shit for them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like with the Vietnam War, for example. You know, when the soldiers got home, so many of the hippies and stuff were spitting on them and shit when they got back. I think we've grown a lot since then. Now we realize those were just kids who were being fed lies about what they were doing overseas. The real people, you know, to blame is McNamara and the folks the politicians who never had to watch somebody die or see their friends bleed out, who sent them out there. And obviously it's an extreme example, but on a micro level, that's how I feel about politics in the US. If I see someone wearing a Trump hat screaming, if anything, I'm more upset with the people that sold them the hat and the people that made them feel like they had to come out and scream. Because evidently nobody just wakes up without being hypnotized by something external and decides, I'm going to go out with four flags and scream about Kobe Bryant in the streets.
Yeah. Who are those people that you think are to blame in you mentioned the people who sell the hats. What is their, what do you see as the broad system that informs them and underlines their interest?
They just want money and power and influence. At the end of the day, like most people who create this hypnotic political programming don't have to live with the consequences because they're doing well. It's the families of people like Kelly who suffer.
Hmm. So, and you see that as news organizations and I don't know, people who capitalize on like
a lot
Stop
of it is just like
t-shirts or something.
I mean, part of it is like grifters selling t-shirts. Sure. But yeah. a lot of it isn't necessarily the grifters themselves, but this whole like late stage capitalist nightmare that we're in to where everything's so expensive. And the only way to get ahead is just by making money any way you can in this cutthroat economy, and ad revenue driven outrage content just beats journalism any day. You know, and the echo chambers outrage sells much more than information.
How have you been able to compete and hang? Because I don't see your stuff as outrage driven.
No. I just try my best. I like to think that like Channel 5 fans at least like aren't going to fall for the bait. You know, a lot of times what I'll do is I'll take an outrage driven story and I'll show the reality of what's happening. Like with the migrant gang takeover in Colorado. Mm-hmm. That the outrage bait thing created that news cycle, but Channel 5's role was to actually kind of follow that to its core and figure out what's actually happening at this apartment complex. Mm-hmm. Is there a gang takeover, or did the landlord hire a PR firm in Florida to make a hit piece about this gang after he abandoned his property, which is true?
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I think you do a good job of highlighting the humanity of these situations, which isn't easy. It is easier to say, you know, these people are bad. And the reason that it's easier, if we had to go, so there's responsibility of the people that are shaping these narratives. Mm-hmm. But also, I do think that there's a collective individual responsibility for, they serve a psychological purpose, as we talked about, which is like, if you tell me that that's the bad guy, I'm very eager to listen to that because I've got issues in my own life.
Yeah.
And if I can get outside and yell at that other guy, that pulls me away from those issues.
Exactly, man. And to that point, I think there's like some kind of deep spiritual sickness in the country or something.
Yeah.
Like there's something wrong with us.
What do you think that is?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out. You know what I mean? It's just something weird, man. It might have something to do with our lack of connections to the land.
Huh.
It might have something to do with just like our identity confusion, just kind of being ripped away from the old world and kind of had to forge this new identity here that's based upon the economic exploitation of the rest of the world. I don't know. It's weird, man. I'm not trying to get too like Marxist on him.
I don't think that's Marxist at all. Okay. I think that's, I hadn't considered that up until a few months ago, but when you see America as a nation without ancestors, and then you think of the importance of ancestors and mythology from all over the world and this like sense that we are here and stewards of the land and I come from a lineage and there are people who are proud of and counting on me who have already passed on. And then America's just like, prior to your grandparent, it's just nothing.
Yeah, like this is ours, I guess.
You know?
And Native Americans are less than 2.5% of the population. And, you know, for whatever reason, when they colonized the United States, they didn't want to create a sort of hybrid race like they did in Mexico. Mm. You know, the Mexican ancestry is a combination of Spanish, mestizo, and indigenous. But if you look at the conquest of North America, I don't know what the difference in their policy was, but there's very few groups of people that almost none where it's a split of white and Native American ancestry.
Mm.
So it was a conscious choice. Maybe they saw the mistakes of what they felt like Cortez did in Mexico and the English decided, you know what, let's stay as far away from Native Americans as we can. Mm. But now it's like we're so rootless and disconnected and this idea of Americanness is just an abstraction that many people feel is one thing, but it literally means nothing. I mean, some people say, oh, America is a melting pot. America is Manhattan, where you have the little pieces of the entire world, you know, coming by at 100 miles an hour. Or they think America is the cornfields of Iowa, where people, you know, there's no crime, there's no immigrants, and people play baseball like in the sand lot after school and they run home. You know, so it literally, America is a totally different thing to every single person, depending on where you are.
Got it. Do you have it? This might be beyond my pay grade for certain, maybe yours. I don't know if you've thought about it, but that, I mean, having a national identity is essentially, it's a mythology. It's not real. It can't possibly account for all of those micro experiences that people have. Do you think that we need a unifying national mythology?
Yeah, it seems to work pretty well for every other country.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and every country without one also has similar problems. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, you know, all these places with no real cohesive national mythology and ancestry are kind of experiencing similar problems.
Do you see a difference? It looks to me from the outside that the right is attempting to create that mythology, and at least with a sense of pride, true or false, right or wrong, historically accurate or not, that there is a, you know, an American first sort of mentality.
Yeah.
And then on the left, there is a sense of we need to pay for the sins of our past and undo America.
Mm-hmm. I think the big problem too is like when the left presents that, I do think there's a case for reparations, but there can be reparations without white guilt and extreme class guilt. I actually think a lot of that stuff sets it behind. Like if you watch a video that we made called Uhuru March for Reparations, it's a bunch of white people, like gentrifiers in Oakland, who are marching around crying about the sins of white people in the past. That doesn't actually help to advance anybody. If anything, it probably makes whoever you're trying to help really uncomfortable, I would imagine,
you know?
Especially if they weren't there either.
Yeah.
Reparations are needed, but they should be administered on a systemic level. Education investment, clearing up food deserts, not these salacious, like, you know, give someone, I mean, go to the hood with a bunch of iPads.
Your video where it's like, I have $5?
Yeah, that's the same
that's
video.
You guys. Yeah.
But when people hear reparations, they think, oh man, so you're expecting all these white people out here to just give their laptops to random people in the hood? Yeah. No, it's a systemic, I guess, reinvestment into certain areas. Like if you go to New Orleans, for example, back in the 1800s, if you were black, you couldn't go west or uptown of Canal Street without a written certification from a white person, right? Today, uptown is still the wealthiest part of the city, and the poorest parts of the city are those where only slaves and newly freed people of color could live in the 1800s, right? Those areas still have no grocery stores, no healthy food, bad schools, no hospitals, cops won't go there. The whole infrastructure is still completely flipped on its head as it was back in the day. So what you got to do is just change that, and things will sort of sort themselves out. But it will take time. It'll take multiple generations. Reparations isn't something that's going to take effect and just transform certain cultural attitudes that have developed in the past 30, 40 years. For example, like in certain places, like especially in the black community, you're coming up on like the fifth generation of people on welfare and complete state dependence. Mm-hmm. That was a deliberate plan set forth to reduce black home ownership in the 1960s. There's no question about that. They tore down all these areas to build projects and low-income Section 8 housing because they didn't want land ownership, because that's the thing the establishment fears the most. So that was a long time ago. Me going to an area like the projects now and telling somebody that would be like some weird, insane, white savior, college-educated bullshit. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, do you know you're only in a gang CIA dismantled the Black Panthers? That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
You have to administer reparations on a systemic level, and it will take effect after a couple generations.
So when we say administer, is that an economic intervention? Because it seems to me, this seems to be one of the problems, is that money alone can't fix it, because one of the outcomes of these very differential historical experiences that people had is generations of in-group abuse in some cases, you know, like is generations of poor education, is a total cultural shift in values that even if you were to start from day one and just be like, okay, all the money got distributed evenly to these people, because we have now, unfortunately, historically informed different values based on the experiences of our great great grandparents, that there was problems, you know, money would shift and align towards different groups. It would be my expectation.
Yeah. Well, funding education has reduced crime every time.
Mm.
You know, so there's just certain things. You're not going to create the immediate sort of like, you know, reparations tomorrow, bright future thing that a lot of people expect when they hear that word. But yeah, it's definitely an economic investment, but it's long term, and it's about maintaining it at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a lump sum that gets awarded to the descendants of people who are slaves. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make any sense.
Got it.
Yeah. And it shouldn't be paid by the city. I mean, it's literally a reallocation of resources on a city planning level. I think that's the best way to do it.
Got it. When going back to the left versus right, you've seen sort of extremists on both sides.
Yeah.
I'm curious if there's an emotion that predominates one side versus the other? Is it just anger on both sides? You mentioned guilt, perhaps.
Like- yeah. I think that on the left, it's hard because like when you're talking about the right, mm-hmm. the Kelly Johnsons and conservative hardcore people, like they may be a fringe, but their ideas have definitely bled into mainstream conservatism, 100%. Mm-hmm. When you talk about the left, if you were to like point to like Antifa or the Revolutionary Communist Party, those concepts have not bled into mainstream liberalism. Mm-hmm. So the fringe of the left is not as influential as the conservatives would make you think. There's, liberals and leftists are still completely separate, whereas conservatives, it's a pretty wide umbrella and everyone's got some skin in the game, whether mm-hmm. you're a chill guy who happens to be pro-choice or a Nazi, you like Trump either way. Okay. You know what I mean? So you know, okay, so the emotion is anger
On the right or on both,
on both sides of the extreme.
Yeah,
definitely. Okay. Anger, but like I said, one is about we need America to be great, and the other one is America will be great after we get you guys out of the picture.
Yeah.
Or they probably wouldn't say America will be great. They'll say, after we redistribute all this land to the First Nations, mm-hmm. it'll be great. Like, mm-hmm. it's so funny. When I was, during 2020, there was also a lot of like Antifa protests in DC. And some of the conversations they have are just as like insular and insane as QAnon. Like, I talked to this one guy who was like fully masked up, and he was like, right now our focus is treaty building. He goes, once we assume power of the capital, we need to figure out how to distribute all this land back to. I was like, dude, you are so far from that position.
Yeah.
But in their mind, everyone is an inch away from power. And that's only got to be a result of internet echo chambers. Because if you were to go into the streets, you wouldn't feel that way.
Yeah, it feels so disconnected from reality. Mm-hmm. And that's what I guess I'm interested in, is like the personal appeal that these people have to pretending that they are on the verge of power, mm-hmm. while actually behaving in ways that seemingly abdicate their opportunity to accumulate real power.
That's a great way to put it. It completely does abdicate any possible political, you know.
Yeah,
totally. No, it's very fascinating. Mm. And from a human psychology level, it's almost like you think you're speaking the future into existence, but you're mm-hmm. actually making it impossible.
Huh. I don't know that this is true. I'm just starting to formulate this because I want to make a video on Donald Trump in the next couple of weeks. And yeah. I'm trying to like describe why, you know, whatever he is, he's been effective at achieving his own goals.
Yeah. He's a genius. You can't take that away from the guy.
Yeah, effective. And what I see in him, particularly with a lot of these executive orders, is a real comfort with hard power.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that the left in particular struggles with. Yeah. So this thing that just happened, 2 days ago with Colombia, where—
What happened?
So he is sending the migrants to Colombia, the illegals that he's picked up, but he puts them on a military airplane. And the president of Colombia doesn't want that photo up, doesn't want them coming on a military airplane, wants them on a passenger airplane, sends the plane back. Trump says immediate 25% tariffs on Colombia. The president writes this, you know, Colombia is strong, Colombia is boom, but caves in an hour, yeah. right? And so Donald Trump is someone who is not afraid to wield hard power and axe people. He's cut people from The Apprentice. He's cut people from his things. Yeah. He's screwed people over and short paying them for projects that he's been on and used bankruptcy law to his. He will like go to the mat for power. And I do think that's when we were talking about these, some of the people on the left, they're like feeling like they're an inch away from power while they scream in the streets. I think there's actually some sort of emotional discomfort with the honest to God wielding of power that makes them fantasize about it.
That's really interesting. I never thought about that before, but it definitely is like a fantasy of control almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I wonder how many of those people would be comfortable, because I'm not one, like running a business and firing someone.
Yeah.
It's for me, that's a harrowing experience.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there's so much wanting people to agree that it's almost easier to act out those power fantasies of like what you would do in a safe way that is not real.
Especially if you know that y'all tear each other down so much that would be impossible.
Yeah. Well, it's scary to have power because when you fire that person or tear someone else down, now there's a target on your back.
And that's the great irony of the people on the right who criticize the left for being collectivists. Like, you guys are communists. You don't believe in the, you know, pick yourself up by the bootstraps, rugged individualism. Mm. Yet they have displayed the most successful example of collectivism in recent times.
Mm, tell me about that.
Well, like I was telling you, they could have extreme disagreements and conservatives will still put those aside to vote for a common cause when the day comes.
Mm.
You know, they weren't able to do that on the left. Part of that had to do with the fact that Kamala Harris wouldn't take a strong stance on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Mm. I think that if she were to come out and say that she supports a two-state solution and wasn't calling Hamas terrorists, I think that would have gotten her millions and millions of votes.
Mm.
I think that if Bernie Sanders wasn't disenfranchised in 2016 during the primaries, he would have beat Trump.
Interesting.
And because every single person my age loves Bernie Sanders.
So your perspective is if the left leaned more towards, radical is not the word, but like to lefter with Bernie or with Kamala, you think they would do better in general elections?
Oh yeah, for sure. Because I mean, dude,
they certainly didn't win. So
Kamala Harris campaigned with Dick Cheney's wife in the last ditch effort to get votes. Can you imagine what that's like for a young progressive voter?
Mm-hmm.
Who was that for? Was that to get Iraq war veterans on your side? Dick Cheney sent us into Iraq for no reason. Who the hell young would be like, oh, you know what? Oh, Kamala's out there with Liz Cheney. All right, she's got my vote. It's so out of touch. And I think that's part of the reason that Trump won too, is he speaks off the cuff. He says what he wants. He's not afraid to wield power because the Democrats wield insane power too. Obama deported more people than Trump has.
Mm.
But he's not okay with saying that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
If I had to give some credit to the Democratic establishment and their strategy, which obviously didn't pan out Hillary and Kamala, it would be that for three consecutive terms, they ran as not Donald Trump. And they won one of them. You know, like, I think Joe Biden represents not Donald Trump. I don't think a lot of people were like, absolutely, we've been waiting for this guy to be president for a long time. And I think they thought if they did that again with Kamala and didn't take any strong positions and just said, not that guy, that they could pull it off again.
And let's keep it real. Mythology-wise, Donald Trump's story is insanely epic. Holy shit, can you imagine that? Reality TV star to president, and then you lose, and your supporters storm the Capitol. He has his, like, nine-month canceled era where he's hanging out with the MyPillow guy and, like, anybody that will fucking, like, get his back, and he's in the White House. I mean, if you're just looking at it on, like, an American cinematic storyline level, that's Rocky II right there. Oh, you know what I mean? So I'm just saying, like, it's not like it's part of that's also why people like him so much, is he has that just like straight up comeback story. And a lot of people, they care more about that than the politics itself.
All right, well, let's take it back to Dear Kelly.
So
I don't want to spoil
I can
spoil it. That's okay.
That's fine.
Okay, how did you feel, because you took a very personal interest in this guy? Connected with him for years, got to know his family, seemed very personally invested in his healing.
Definitely.
And he made some strides, but ultimately still at the end of it remained fairly disconnected from his family. Because, well, even zooming back, I would love for you to detail, before we get to this, what you see as like the three pieces of what drives radicalization.
Yeah.
Because this informed your approach to him.
So prior to radicalization, I think there's three core needs that when they collapse, create the opportunity for radicalization. So I think, and I thought of this like totally independently, but apparently it's relatively similar to a guy named Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But I believe the three core needs are security, significance, and connection. Security asks like, am I safe? Roof over your head. Like, am I going to be able to eat today? Significance asks, do I matter? And that's typically in turn aligned with like legacy and contribution. Like, obviously, I find significance in doing what I'm doing, making documentary films. I probably find security in like the house that I'm able to afford because of the documentary films. So they all kind of, I think those first two core needs are intertwined, significance and security. The third core need, and I think is the most essential one, is connection. And that's ask the question, like, am I loved? Do people like me? Do I have someone that I really feel like I can connect with? And if you don't have that, it's extreme loneliness. And if you compound loneliness with the absence of security and significance, and you're in a position where you went from like hero to zero, whether it be you lose your job, you lose your house, you lose your wife, you lose custody of your children, in that sort of horrible down-in-the-dump state is where you're most susceptible to being brainwashed by politicized media, because it feeds on that outrage and sort of like paradise lost sensation. Yeah,
totally. And if I had to, I 100% agree with that. And I also see the personal responsibility of like, I think those types attach to the narrative in that moment, because it saves from the excruciating pain of confronting the loss of these three fundamental human needs.
And also, the part of the narrative is the apocalypse. There's a religious element too. You know, when you've lost everything, you feel like your world is ending. And in some cases, maybe it has. Now you have media like InfoWars in particular, which says the world is going to end. We are on the edge. America's going to collapse. Civilization, Western civilization as we know it, is in its final stage unless you get involved in this. So they see a chance to almost secondhand redeem their own situation through this grander battle.
Yeah.
And I think that is what drove a lot of the radical Trump shit.
Got it. So it's these very personal wounds and losses mm-hmm. that fit into the narrative, this broader political narrative, whether yes. it's they're taking our jobs or you're being replaced or they want AI to become you, whatever it is.
Yeah. And it's not just here. I mean, that's how it works in the Middle East, too.
Mm-hmm.
Most people in groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS had, you know, normal lives that were torn apart by wars, many of which were a direct result of foreign intervention.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So if you grew up in Iraq during the early 2000s, there's a high likelihood that you lost a cousin, you know, something like that, or a mom, a dad,
yeah.
to American or Iraqi forces. You get older and someone tells you, you know, what happened and tells you how to feel and how to process that and where to channel that grief.
Yeah. So being that the collapse of those needs creates the radicalization, part of what you experiment with is, what if we restored connection to Kelly's life? What might be possible if we did that?
Well, ironically, I think that the connection was the one element that he was able to get from the magosphere. If you watch that final scene, it's very strategic. The final scene at the America Fest after the intervention, mm-hmm. there's three videos back to back. One, they're all about connection.
Mm.
You know, you have security, which is like, I've got a job. You have significance, like, it's me, Kelly. And then connection, yeah. like, I love you, man. It's yeah. all very deliberate.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah. And yeah.
So, yeah, so what you tried to do with the family, and you did do, was have an intervention with his wife and children
yes.
to confront him about how his behavior was affecting them.
Yes.
And talk about that.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't actually my idea. You know, that's part of the thing. It's definitely the most intense scene that I've ever filmed, because typically, I mean, I've done serious journalism before, I've covered serious issues, but an intimate family setting like that was very definitely a hard bridge to cross for me, you know, because intervention, I've never even been to an intervention off camera at all.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you have, but it's like, dude, I mean, I've seen the TV shows and it's very intense, lots of tears. But, you know, it was Kelly's family's idea to have the intervention. His daughter, Kaylee, thought, now's the time. He's planning on moving out of state. We have an election coming up. We feel like this is our last chance to reach him before he dives off the deep end.
Mm.
And they felt like, because of the connection that I'd built with him throughout the course of filming, that I was the only person who could get him to agree to it. And so a lot of people need to realize, too, the intervention wasn't a surprise. I told him, I didn't use the word intervention, but I told Kelly at the Starbucks where I met him, I said, we're going to do a filmed family therapy session,
yeah.
which is a light way of saying intervention. Yeah, yeah. I think he understood.
Just fair, which is an honest way to describe it. Now, this is, I think, one of the hopeful but frustrating things about it, is that to step back into connection with his family, who were very vulnerable and shared the ways that his radicalization had impacted them. One of his daughters is crying because yeah. she's developed an eating disorder, which is yeah. very clearly connected to the, you know, the loss of her father and the yeah. the issues with control and feeling good and all of that stuff. And he's moved by it.
Yeah.
But ultimately, when you revisit him again at the end of it, is back in sort of the magosphere and not yeah. as connected with his family.
You know, there was some light wins, though. I mean, at the same time, His resentments towards Bill Joyner were set aside by mm-hmm. the end of the film. He didn't move to Arizona. He's still here in California.
Okay, so he's so, like, I mean, got some contact.
Some micro wins.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people, when they think of an intervention, are kind of coded by like TLC mm-hmm. to expect like a 90 days later, like new guy, turn over a new leaf. But that's not a reality a lot of times, yeah. unfortunately. But I think that the intensity of an intervention can make people want to change in the moment. But interventions, they do deploy shame and guilt as a tactic.
Okay.
And I think that shame and guilt might get you to go to treatment, but it's not going to make you have long-term sobriety or real tangible change unless you actually want to do it. You know, imagine that situation too, where cameras weren't rolling and I wasn't
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the heat was on for him to agree to go to a mental health recovery facility.
And so there's external pressure.
Absolutely.
That isn't simply, I love my family. It's, I yeah. might want to appear this way or say yes for the camera or
something. I mean, most interventions, you're surrounded by six of your family members and yeah. they're all crying. Uh-huh. And so you're in fight or flight.
Yeah.
Obviously, you hate yeah. seeing the people you love sad. And they're telling you this can stop if you do this thing.
Yeah.
I don't even know if interventions are an effective thing, to be honest.
That's a good question. Do you have a sense of what is it? So I think I very much agree with your diagnosis yeah. of the problem. I don't know what the term, it's not prognosis, but like, what's the treatment for these sorts of things? How do you bring someone back who's been radicalized and has separated themselves from their family and their loved ones in order to join the apocalypse fighting right. cause?
I think that is like the coolest conversation that has stemmed from the movie in general.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know. I mean, I'm only 27. I'm still trying to figure the world out too, you know?
Yeah.
Like, me and all my friends, most of my friends are still trying to find work after college at this point. Yeah. You know, it's like, so, I mean, probably some kind of long-term mental health treatment or something like that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, I also feel like the terms of the intervention weren't super clear. Mm. You know, it's like, I feel like everybody wanted different things. I feel like Kaylee, the more liberal daughter, I feel like she wanted a political transformation. I feel like Sydney, the youngest daughter, wanted a more present father.
Yeah.
And I feel like Kyle just wanted like a friend because he's the oldest one. He just wanted like a homie to actually chill with and not have to be so stressed out about politics.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wanted whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't know. Generally, I was satisfied with it to a certain extent. But also, like I said, you know, this movie was filmed over the course of 4 years. But a lot can change in 4 years from now.
Sure.
Kelly is going to live for decades longer, probably. By 2028, we'll see. Mm-hmm. If Trump does good things for the country, I'm going to report on those things. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of these channels that has like TDS, Trump derangement syndrome, mm-hmm. and is going to work whatever angle they can to make it look like nothing is getting better in the country. Mm-hmm. If the bottom line is raised for working class Americans here, I'm going to report that as well.
Yeah.
So in that same vein, 2028, that's the goalpost year.
Yeah.
By 2028, if Trump, as Uncle Pill said, if Trump kills it and everything's great, well then Kelly, man, thanks.
Yeah.
If he didn't, you know, well, he's probably going to feel a little bit duped.
Yeah.
Either way, it'll be more chill.
Yeah. Well, I guess the political piece seems secondary to the familial piece for me. When I saw that, I was like, dude, your kids all want and need you. And the most profound impact you can make on the world is in this home right here. Like, you can transform the relationships that your daughters have with men forever by showing up for them right now, save them a lot of money on therapy, you know, and, or you can go stand at a booth at a MAGA convention and convince yourself that you're fighting the big fight. So that was not a disappointment, but the sadness, I suppose, that I felt.
Definitely.
Have you felt that you've ever seen someone or been effective yourself? Maybe this isn't a goal of yours in changing someone's mind who has sort of gone into a deep, radicalization place?
I would like to think so.
Okay.
I'd like to think that maybe the all gas 2020 era changed some people's minds, but I'm not really sure.
Tell me if you could think of any or broadly, what contributes to that? Because I a lot of people sit down with their uncle at Thanksgiving and scream at him or ignore him or something him and are frustrated by this. Yeah. And I'm very curious because you've got such a broad experience with people of all sorts of beliefs. What moves people?
I don't know if I've so much been able to move people from the deep end back to reality. But what I've done that I think is more important is I have made people like the liberals who might go to Thanksgiving and scream at their QAnon uncle. I think I've given them a chance to relax.
Okay.
I think I've given them the ability to see what shaped that mentality. And I like to think that Channel 5 has relaxed some Thanksgiving dinners somewhere along the line.
I think that's great.
And that is a big achievement.
What's his name? There's the guy, Daryl. I don't know his name. He is, he would convert members of the KKK. If you
Daryl Davis?
Daryl Davis.
Yeah, he's like a blues musician, right?
Yeah, blues musician, black guy who I think he's got like 100 KKK robes because he would go hang out with them and essentially show them compassion and humanity and not rise to their racist remarks, but instead would continue to maintain human connection with them. And I think he wound up with a grand master of the KKK or grand dragon, they're called, or
one of their stupid ass names.
One of their like most lordly names hung up his robes as a result. So it does seem that like this is, I think, the therapeutic insight is that continued human connection through all of your defense mechanisms, provided that you're not being physically threatened, seems to be one of the things that can heal people.
Yeah, especially if you can reach some kind of cultural commonality. And I think that was the case with Daryl Davis especially. It's like, you know, an old black guy who's a blues musician from Mississippi and an old Klansman, they've got a couple of things in common. They probably like the same kind of music, the same kind of food. They almost fucking sound the same.
Yeah, interesting.
You know what I mean? And so like it's random stuff where you have so much more in common with someone than you think. And
yeah.
You guys just hang out one time and you're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
But I love that guy's podcast, or I've seen him on Joe Rogan before.
Oh yeah. Have you seen, there was just a recent video with, I don't know if you know who Gideon is. He went and hung out with one of the most racist men in America.
Yeah.
It's great. And it was, the guy is making like sort of, you know, racist comments throughout, but there's clearly a bond being formed and the ability, which is tough and nobody, it's nobody's job, but to not take that seriously and to see the human underneath, which is like, that's like saintly work to a degree order to do that. And it's not expected, but it's transformative. And I don't know. I was moved by that video.
The Gideon video?
Yeah.
I'm going to have to watch it. I just watched the first 2 minutes and I was like, bro, I need to take a breath before I watch this. But he's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah. It was a great video. Let's talk about Bill Joyner.
Okay.
Do you have some resentment towards Bill Joyner these days?
I have no resentment toward Bill Joyner.
I don't know what you could say about it. There's a lawsuit, or was a lawsuit at the end of Dear Kelly.
Is a lawsuit.
Currently. Is a lawsuit. How do you feel?
Bad. I don't like being sued, but I don't think the lawsuit is, I don't think the claims are justified.
Got it. So you think you'll be ultimately exonerated and...
Yeah, I mean, it's a civil trial or something like that. I mean, there's claims in the lawsuit that aren't true, yeah. Such as the violation of the Federal Wiretap Act.
Uh-huh.
There's certain stuff in there that I just can tell you for certain is not true.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think that, so the lawsuit was filed before we did a screening tour a long time ago. And I think the lawsuit, from the language in the lawsuit, it appears that Bill and his counsel believe, before seeing Dear Kelly, that it is a hit piece about them that espouses Kelly's narratives about the foreclosure.
Got it. And so they were trying, they didn't want Bill Joyner to get a bad reputation as a result of...
We didn't even know Bill Joyner existed for a long time. We thought that he was possibly a figment of Kelly's imagination.
Okay.
Like, or just like someone that, for real, I mean, we didn't know. And so I think that there was a, we did a Channel 5 live tour, and I think it was someone on stage, like Uncle Bill, he yelled like, fuck Bill Joyner. Like, you know, we didn't know he was real. And then we got sued. I remember I got the cease and desist in the mail, and I was like, holy shit, Bill is real.
Wow.
Because we couldn't reach him. We thought he was maybe like a shell company that used a human name to evade responsibility.
Did you panic when that comes through? Like,
no, I was excited. Because I realized, oh my God, I might be able to get him for an interview. But then I realized that's probably not going to happen if I'm being sued.
Do you have less fear than most people? Because what's that about? Because I would not that you did anything wrong. I would probably have been less likely to put myself in a situation where I was going to be sued.
Yeah.
And you regularly go into like these very aggressive zones and seem very cool, calm, and collected. You seem able to disconnect from some of the fears that other people would experience.
Yeah, I don't really have that much fear.
Yeah.
But then again, I get scared about random stuff like loud noises, like fireworks and stuff. Huh. I don't like it. Random sensory stuff. Like I saw that movie Smile 2 the other day. I couldn't even sit through it. Just because of the dramatic breaks between quiet and extreme loud.
Wow.
I don't like when things get quiet and loud, like random sensory stuff. Sound pretty spectrum.
Yeah,
out right
I was going to say, that sounds super spectrum-y.
But like when it comes to real life situations, I don't have any fear.
Wow. Do you know if you're neurodivergent in any?
I've got to be.
Yeah.
But
I guess it is all a spectrum. It's just like there's different people with different brains and yours.
My brain's also kind of messed up from like adolescent psilocybin mushroom abuse.
Okay.
So so I'm sort of on a different planet all the time.
Yeah.
So when I'm in these situations, I'm not nervous. Like hopping the border, wasn't nervous. At that drug dealer stash house in Philly, wasn't nervous.
Wow.
But then I watch the footage over and I think, yo, I shouldn't have been there.
Holy cow.
You know what I mean? Because I watch it, I'm like, bro, what was I thinking?
Huh.
So I got to start thinking through the future Andrew lens more now.
Really? Because it's like the future lens can see it from an objective that's dangerous. But I guess you're not feeling that first person danger.
Yeah. And I guess I'm so warped by the internet too to where when something bad is happening, I was like, wow, that's going to be a crazy video. It's like Logan Paul in the Suicide Forest.
Yeah.
I'm like, what the fuck? That guy's dead. That's how I feel. I'm not that far, but you know.
No,
what
no,
I'm
no. But there's a dissociative quality to being an influencer, which is you view everything through the lens. Oh, which God. Is,
I hope I don't fall under that category.
Whatever what it is, though, when you walk around with a camera and you think of the world in terms of titles, that creeps in there, which is like, oh, dude, that's great fucking content,
whether you like it or not.
And yes, and it becomes that YouTube homepage, that YouTube studio thing becomes like a function of how your brain works. Like that's a 1 of 10 video.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. No, it's true. And there's no way to avoid it.
Yeah.
Especially if you came up online and you have an e-commerce business. But I try to not lean into like the clickbait titles or the clickbait
keyframes. Sure. No, you do a great job.
And it's kind of part of the anti-marketing that I try to do. Like I'll never be like visiting the craziest place in the world.
Well, you've done an excellent job of not doing that. And so you don't have to constantly up the ante with your titles. You can just say where you are and people have learned that what they're going to get is a Channel 5 video.
And that's the best thing. It's like when you have, people have that unconscious trust of like, might not be a crazy video, but it's going to be, might not be a crazy title or keyframe, but it's going to be a crazy video.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good for you, man, because I think there's a, I've gone back and forth on that. It pays dividends to not clickbait like that. To develop an audience that just trusts. You can call it Dear Kelly. You can call it whatever you want.
It's more important than numbers.
Mm.
Because you could do a thousand views.
Yeah.
And if it's 1,000 authentic people who are engaging with the work you're putting out, that is better than 10 million randos who are just clicking on it because they're like, have some little fear interest.
Some reaction.
Yeah, they're just like, oh, what the fuck? You know, they click on it. They're not remembering you. They're just like watching. They're probably watching 10 seconds of it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the business of Channel 5?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I'm so cute. Like, is it growing? How is it going?
Yeah, it's growing super fast.
Yeah.
So we're primarily funded by Patreon. So people pay $5 a month for early releases, extended cuts of content, like some behind the scenes office content, random stuff.
Yeah.
But we don't give like that much more on Patreon. It's more just a way for people to feel like they're a part of the spine of the organization, which they are.
Yeah.
So we have that. And then we have like ads that we place on videos every other video.
Mm-hmm.
And then
you don't even do every video.
No, no, no.
Wow.
Because some videos, it's pretty like tasteless to put an ad.
Okay.
Like the LA wildfires video.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be like, well, this is pretty sad, but you guys got to check out NordVPN. You know, if you're in Lithuania and you want to watch
Do you mean sponsorships or do you mean ads?
Sponsorship, like, oh, we put ads on every
video. Okay, ads are on every video.
Yeah, yeah. But great. I'm saying like sponsored ad reads.
Sponsored ad reads. I understand.
You ever played Clash of Clans?
Oh my God.
Anyways,
imagine
back
woman
to the Derek Chauvin trial verdict.
At the Altadena fire being like, could you just hold this?
Yeah. You know, Flappy Bird. It is relaunching.
Oh man, got it. Okay, so you do sponsorships, you do that, and it's growing quickly.
Yeah.
What is driving that? Is it just increase of
just a higher volume of content production? You know what I mean? I'm writing books now. The Dear Kelly documentary, expanding the team internationally to different continents and countries. Like we have a Mexican correspondent, New Zealand correspondent, Middle Eastern correspondents, all that.
Dude, so many questions about this. One of the things that I've been impressed by, in my own, is that it's really hard for channels that are built around a personality, which is like, you know, even though it's called Channel 5, like we expect to see you in every video, to add different hosts to the format. And it seems like you have done very well at doing that.
I'm actually surprised by that it's gone so well.
Yeah.
Because my first thought is like, I'm going to dilute the brand if I bring on these personalities.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do when I bring personalities on is I will add a supplemental interview that I've conducted.
Mm.
So, for example, when we had the Hezbollah-Israel conflict video,
all
that coverage was from our Lebanese and Israeli correspondents.
Mm-hmm.
But I interviewed a UCLA professor of Middle Eastern studies to drop it in so people still see me and their mind registers, okay, Andrew's still on this project.
Yeah.
His tentacles are still somehow pulling the strings here. I'm sort of the Jewish deep state behind the videos. And I'm not even Jewish, but you know, you get the point.
What is your role for those videos? Are you acting as editor?
I edit. I do the voiceovers, do the research, all that stuff.
Got it. There's an editorial aspect that is I chop up the video, but there's also a, like, what angle do we take on this, which can be heavily influenced in post? Do you see that as your role or do
you? Yeah, for sure. My role, I also have like a few editors that work for Channel 5.
Uh-huh.
We make those calls together, but it's mostly me.
Do you do a lot of the video editing? Because you guys like, in my mind, famous for the crash zoom and like—
Yeah,
you
back
know,
in the day.
Yeah.
I do. Yeah, I do most of it.
Okay.
But my goal is to not do it.
Yeah.
Because I've just done— Adobe Premiere is like my worst nightmare.
Yeah. Well, you know, you built a very unique style, which I think somebody can now emulate. But had you done that from the jump, it wouldn't have been—
Yeah. That's kind of the cool thing about hiring new editors now is most of the time they've seen a bunch of Channel 5 videos. So they already kind of
they
like
know. Just to like get in on this.
Yeah. They know what I'm looking for. They know about the square around the center of the head.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This one.
Yeah.
When the frame is just the nose, eyes, and mouth. And if they know that and they know the music style and how we incorporate news clips over royalty-free music, all that shit.
I'm curious if you have a sense, because the interview that you will conduct in real time is like you're very open and calm.
Yeah.
And then the edit of it is funny because you're doing this ridiculous zoom into like a booger that somebody has.
We're trying to get away from that.
So I'm curious how people feel or have felt if you've ever gotten follow-ups from people that like did an interview and then realized that part of the interview has funny zooms on their face.
So I'm trying to stop the zooming.
Okay.
But sometimes the camera guys can't stop themselves because I hire my friends only. You know what I mean? And they all have, you know, attention deficit disorder. So they're just like zooming in and out.
Yeah.
But back in the day, Quarter Confessions, all gas. It was nothing but crash zooms.
Yeah.
But what started to happen is not only were people upset about being featured on the show, we started getting interview rejections because of our presentation. So I'd want to interview a politician or somebody important, and they'd be like, yeah, we reviewed your portfolio. Yep. It's not really for us.
Fair enough.
And then we started running into what's called the Borat problem. So Jonah Hill, big name drop, super bad star Jonah Hill, who produced This Place Rules. He told me he used He told me that he used to work for Borat, Sacha Baron Cohen. Mm-hmm. And the reason it took them 10 years to make Borat 2 was because after the success of the first movie, Sacha Baron Cohen would get in the character, go back into the field, and people would be like, oh my God, that's Borat, my wife. Yeah. And it was impossible to kind of cloak yourself because the costume's blown.
Yeah.
I was running into that problem with All Gas, No Breaks, where I would go somewhere and people would run up to the microphone and yell what they think I wanted them to say. So, I eat ass, butthole. Yeah. Let me tell you about my craziest acid trip. And it was just like, we have to change our content and our editing fundamentally. Huh. And I have to ditch the suit for a long time in order to restore the organic interview dynamic.
Wow. So, what direction do you want things to go? Do you want those political interviews with those heads of state and...
The secret dream is to build Channel 5 into a real news organization, and then I'm going to start another show.
A cult. No.
I'm going to start another show. I'm really going to buy back All Gas, No Breaks.
Oh, really?
But I'm trying to. So, and then I'm going to start another show where it's just me not talking about politics, not getting into any issues, but just surfing around the country, talking to people.
You want to buy back All Gas, No Breaks? Mm-hmm. What is required? What needs to happen for that?
$1 million.
Is that the case?
Yeah.
Got it. And I don't know the whole story. I know that you got pushed out or like...
Something like that. It was just a whole bunch of contractual disputes. But I'm actually on good terms with the whole company now.
Got it.
So shout out to them. They learned a lot since then. So did I.
Uh-huh.
And they graciously returned the All Gas No Brakes RV to me.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It was sick. It was in bad shape, but I got it. I sent it to a mechanic in Phoenix and it's almost done. But it's like they're going to refurbish it. So it's like the old Channel 5, All Gas RV.
So if you can get either like accumulate $1 million from your Patreon and your sponsorships or that sort of stuff, or I don't know, get fundraising, you'll buy back All Gas.
Yeah.
Do you have a timeline?
Shit, I'm trying to do it ASAP. That's why people got to stream Dear Kelly.
Yeah.
That's why I dropped Dear Kelly.
That's why we're here today.
Yeah. Because, imagine I buy back All Gas after fucking 5 years.
Yeah.
Legendary.
Dude, and I just came back to my channel after a couple of years.
Sick.
And purchased it. Yeah.
Okay, dope.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
it's cool. It feels really good.
Yeah, you're back.
Yeah.
Back in action. And then now, by that point, Channel 5 will have a established multinational brand identity.
It's beautiful.
And I can still be involved, but I can get back on the road and just put politics to the side for a bit.
That seems awesome, man. I love that vision because not your videos are excellent, but when you have a correspondent in Gaza, doing that video, this is amazing. And if you can get those correspondents around the world where the stuff is happening.
Yeah, it's actually better that way too. Yeah. I think people prefer coverage from someone who's actually part of the community.
Yeah.
You know, they don't want to see another American guy, you know, in the Congo. They want to see a Congolese guy wearing an All Gas, No Brakes suit doing an interview. It's way sicker. You know what I'm saying? Same shit with Mexico. Like our correspondent, Josue, we just met him at the border a couple days ago for the first time, through the fence.
Mm.
People want to see him go into a illegal cockfighting ring in the country and betting pesos on it. They don't want to see me out there trying to talk broken Spanish to some farmers.
Yeah, your Spanish is,
I know, but not as good as Josue's. He's literally from Mexico.
Yeah. Okay. That's awesome, man. I actually think that both entities will do much better with that.
Oh, yeah. I just want to establish that like when All Gas, No Brakes comes back, we're going back to pre-COVID. We're going to make All Gas great again.
Okay.
You know what I mean? To the point where you're not even going to hear Trump's name. We are going to small towns and we're just going to talk to the people, la gente. That's it.
That's awesome, man. I mean, you seem excited about it.
Fuck yeah, dude. I can't wait to do that.
Yeah, and you got the RV.
I got the RV, but what I want to do this time, I want to buy an ambulance. You know what I mean? Paint it with like cool decals, hollow out the back and build like an actual set and editing studio and just sleep in hotels. Because sleeping in the RV, I don't need to do that anymore. I'll just park the thing outside a hotel. Maybe it'll have a small cot or like a folding bed, like a Murphy bed back there. But dude, imagine there's like a studio like Soft White Underbelly does where it's like a curtain.
A beautiful like shot, or maybe not even beautiful, but iconic.
And it's in the back of an ambulance. Whatever. Chassis. I don't know what it's called. The back of an ambulance.
Yeah. Very cool. I want to ask you, I'm sort of sorting through one of the things that I notice that I'm most attracted to in people is when they're like living their unique gift.
Yeah.
And as I hear you talk about this, it is certainly unique and it seems like your gift and I see how it animates you.
Mm-hmm.
How have you, this is such a big question, but see if you can field it. how did you get there? Like, how did you hone in on this very unique life vision that you've built for yourself?
Well, I think the most important first step is not trying to be a master of none and okay at everything. Mm-hmm. If you're bad at something, just accept that you suck at it. For example, I can't play baseball. I can't even really wash my own clothes. I can't do dishes. I can't change a tire. I can't mm-hmm. ride motorcycles. I'm not good at math. I get bored by science. I was scared of animals. There's many things that I can't do. Mm-hmm. And so figure out what it is that you are okay at pretty good and just try to get as good at that specific thing as possible.
For you, what was that?
Just reporting.
Reporting.
You know what I mean? Because I always knew, like, because I was always kind of an average student, you know, I was more mm-hmm. concerned with socializing and shit in high school and partying. But I found this one class and I was like, oh my God, I'm hella good at this. Mm. You know, and I was like, dude, if I'm good at this, imagine how good I can get if I, you know, stop trying at everything else.
Yeah. And what's interesting is you might not have noticed it consciously at the time, but your like relationship with fear and lack thereof.
Yeah.
It's probably not something you thought about yourself, but it makes you very good at yeah. what you do.
A lot of that came up because I grew up writing graffiti, uh-huh. you know, and tagging. You know,
and so you were constantly doing bad shit. And
yeah, not only just bad shit, but when you grow up that way, your fear sensors go down. If you're climbing on freeway signs and stealing spray paint and running from the police and sneaking out of your house and climbing down fire escapes where you have landlords throwing glass bottles at you and you're jumping on, you're living like Batman before yeah. you're even 18.
Oh my God.
You know, and I don't live that way now, but we're talking 13, 14, 15 years old. Yeah. I was like one of those like bad kids from the city. So like I was already like, to me, going to a fringe event was like a walk in the park.
That's fascinating. I do notice that the people who wind up doing things that are perfect for them turn something that was a challenge in their teen and prepubescent years.
Yeah.
Like for me, I was very shy and that, yeah. but I didn't want to be. And so I like stretched to try to not be as shy and that became my career later
Damn,
in life.
I couldn't even imagine you being shy, bro.
Oh, ridiculous. Like silent.
Like one of those kids in kindergarten who just can't say anything?
It was... You know, kindergarten might have been okay. It was when I got to like middle school.
Oh shit!
That it was like one of the last guys to talk to girls or anything like that. Yeah. I had my very narrow group of friends who I was comfortable with, but put me outside of that, and it was just silence.
Were you like, was that a pre or post puberty thing?
It was during and post. People assumed that you had your growth spurt. You got a little bit of a square jaw. Now you could do it. No, fuck no.
Damn.
It was
so. What did
conscious.
You do to break through that, man?
For me, the first like when I read the game, that was like, holy. Shit.
The Pickup Artist book? Let's go, by Neil Strauss?
Dude, Neil Strauss.
Yo.
That was revelatory for me. And not because, like, at first I, like, tried some of the lines, but just the idea that I could consciously reshape my social life
yeah.
and wasn't doomed to the shyness that I felt contained by.
Well, that's cool that Neil Strauss actually gave some real game.
Yeah.
Because I just thought he teaches you how to get makeouts in Vegas.
K-closes.
Yeah, closes.
But that was the big thing for me. Okay, so... You had this thing when you were little. I also noticed that you're like very willing and even excited about a life that other people, I don't know, wouldn't want, like sleeping in the back of an RV or something like
that.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Like you seem in a very healthy way, not concerned with living the life that other people would want. Like
yeah,
there's no keeping up with the Joneses that I sense in
no,
you.
No, definitely not. I just like, you know, living on the edge, but more so now I'm trying to build some level of stability in my life.
Uh-huh.
You know, I got a girlfriend for like really the first time and some dogs.
Okay.
You know, and I have a nice house for the first time ever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I'm just trying to figure out how to manage that, you know, cause I read something online the other day that the average age of a homeless man in America is 54.
Hmm.
And that just kind of fucked me up, you know? And I was like, a lot of the way that I've been living is for lack of a better term, like cute when you're younger.
Yep.
And then it becomes very dark when you get older.
Bro, how old are you right now?
27.
I will tell you, I have seen this, and I don't think this is true of you. The stuff that is cute in your 20s becomes cancerous in your 30s.
Like what? So,
oh, that guy's like partying a lot at 23. Okay, he's 28. That's like excessive. Okay, now he's 34 and he has liver issues. Like,
oh shit, it happens like, that fast?
I see it in your 30s is where the darkness starts. Mm. And in your 20s, especially early 20s, it's cute.
Yeah,
or like, you know, that guy cheats on all his girlfriends. He can't be contained. And then by your 30s, it's like you're destroying your relationships and people don't trust you.
Yeah.
So it like, yeah. And I don't think that what you're doing, like, there's nothing wrong with living in an RV and
No, you're right. You know, it's, for me, it's like, I don't want to romanticize this kind of destructive behavior of, like, you know what I mean? Like, drink every night, you know what I mean? Like, partying, new people, new girls, all that shit, you know? It gets more loserish as you get older. Mm-hmm. And I even feel like 22 versus 27 is totally different.
Yeah.
I even noticed, I tried to hitchhike the other day. Nobody wanted to pick me up. You know, and I'm like, society is telling me that it's time to relax.
It's time. Yeah. I think as you approach 30, there's a shift. And I mean, you've got...
I can't wait to be in my 30s and be taken seriously at hotels and the rental car facilities. You know, seriously, dude, every time I try to check into a nice hotel, yeah, if the concierge is above 40, it's the worst experience of my life.
Yeah.
It's just depressing.
Why?
I don't know. They resent me. I was in first class the other day. I'm the youngest person by 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. This old ass miserable dude is like, you know, asking what people want for their meal or whatever. And we're on the tarmac. And I take a phone call because my mom calls me and he goes, no phones in first class. And everyone looked around like, holy fuck. There's a visceral anger that older people in America who grew up in the 80s have when they see a young person winning. Because they were promised a good future if they worked their ass off.
And he perhaps imagines that you're like a trust fund kid or
something like that. Or yeah. That I'm a criminal.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably a drug dealer.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. What is the site where people can find Dear Kelly?
You can find Dear Kelly at www.dearkellyfilm.com for a $5.55 rental. Or if you feel so generous, it's available for purchase for $15.55.
Beautiful.
For life.
Yeah. I watched it, enjoyed it, was moved and inspired to reach out to you as a result
of
that.
Yeah, bro. So. Hell yeah. I'm glad to be here. This is a sick ass podcast studio. I know they can't see everything, but there's a motorcycle in the living room in here.
That is not my motorcycle. There's a sign on it.
There's a sign on it that says, please do not sit on the motorcycle.
Our house is a bit like a museum. It's a rental.
Are you the reason for that sign being there?
No. Yeah, technically.
You sat on it?
Well, I came in, they saw the way I looked at it, and there's signs on the bathrooms like, please do not flush tampons.
Really? Yeah. Jeez. Dude, honestly, you ask me if I have fear, I have fear of riding a motorcycle.
Yeah. Well, that seems very healthy.
I don't want to die.
Yeah.
Imagine I have this crazy ass life and I die on the road in a vehicular accident.
Well, technically that would be like, perfect for that archetype.
You know what I mean? Yeah, but like, it's not badass. Like, I want to be assassinated.
Got it. Got it.
I don't want to put that into the world, but like, when I'm like 85, mm-hmm. I'm about to die, I hope I'm so
influential
that the fool's assassinated.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's something we can hold.
Because then you get a statue, and I'm all about recognition. I'm an influencer. I want a statue, bro. I'll build one here in my own house.
Yeah.
I'm
and then kidding. 50 years later, they'll reveal that it was a government
deep state. And they'll make a YouTube video like, inside the craziest statue in Laurel Canyon.
Awesome, man. So, Channel 5 on YouTube.
That's right.
DearKellyFilm.com?
DearKellyFilm.com. Philadelphia is winning. Not just the Eagles,
the Birds.
But me and the homie are in fact winning the podcast game.
So. Awesome, man. Well, thank you for coming. Is there anything else you want to touch on before we wrap?
No, unless you want to.
I'm happy to just whatever.
Sounds good, man.
Beautiful. Thank you, guys. We appreciate you.
Hell yeah.
Taxes was taxing. Now taxes is relaxing when you file for free.
I can file for free? TurboTax Free Edition. Roughly 37% of filers qualify. Simple form 1040 returns only. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free. I can file for free.
Now this is taxes. File for free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your maximum refund. No schedules except for earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and student loan interest. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free.